Hi everyone, I'm Alicia Halliday and this is the ASF Weekly Science Podcast. There is a lot of truth to the observation that there are not enough services for adults because there's a lack of scientific evidence around the needs of adults across the spectrum. The argument has been made that people with autism spend most of their lives as adults, so science should be directing their efforts towards them. Now, I am acknowledging that there are not enough of these studies, and we need more. But at the same time, all adults with autism were, at some time in their lives, children with autism and babies with autism. It's well accepted by psychologists and developmental experts that infancy and childhood are critical, crucial periods when the brain is moldable, shapeable, and plastic, and that the environment has an important role in development. To be clear, here the environment means it all. Access to healthcare, parental care, where they go to school, if they go to preschool, their diet, their experiences, availability of sleep and other visual exposures. It's endless, but let's start with a broad definition of environment. While all genetic influences start prenatally, it's hard to argue against the role of early exposures in infancy and childhood and how they can mold brain development. Early naturalistic behavioral interventions are effective, at least in some kids, because they have the ability to rewire the brain, reshape connections, strengthen the ones that should be there, and redirect the ones that lead to maladaptive behavior. It isn't an all-or-nothing thing, meaning these interventions will not reverse all behavioral symptoms associated with autism, but they can lessen the severity of some behaviors while improving other behaviors, especially those relating to social communication. And while early interventions can start very, very early, and scientists have now shown that the benefits of these interventions are not just seen 6 months later, but years and years later, we still don't have enough information about the critical periods of infancy and childhood in development of autism. The infancy and early childhood period is crucial to understand, to better define, and to determine brain mechanisms so that interventions can be better and improve the lives of children who then become adults with autism. So I'm getting off my soapbox now. Now you know why I feel so strongly that collaborative research projects that both identify the early signs and symptoms of autism, determine behaviors where interventions can make the most impact, and understand how the brain works even before a diagnosis can be made to develop biological markers are so important. One of the leading ways infancy and autism is studied is through the Baby Siblings Research Consortium. Now, you can't have listened to this podcast more than three times without hearing me talk about Baby Siblings Research, but I'll still give you a quick introduction. The Baby Siblings Research Consortium, or BSRC, is a group of over 30 researchers worldwide that study infant siblings of children with autism. These infants have a 15 times greater chance of having an autism diagnosis compared to the general population. So you can understand why this is a prime group to investigate if a scientist or a clinician is interested in the early signs of autism. In fact, some behavioral features are seen even before a diagnosis is made, and even before that, biological features like alterations in brain activity and brain structure can be observed. These provide not just biomarkers for a diagnosis, but biomarkers for better intervention. If people are wondering if an intervention is really working, they can turn to the biology, not just cross their fingers. This week, the Baby Siblings Research Consortium met in Chicago. Not all of them, but quite a number of them, and importantly, a lot of them who were younger investigators, who when I started working with them in 2005 were postdocs or early career researchers. I've been totally blown away and humbled to see how they've contributed to the science over the years, and amazed at how their mentors have helped shape these amazing clinician scientists. There were also members who had been around a while and have incredible institutional memory, decades of experience, and contact with families from over 20 years of research to help guide these important conversations. The data from these decades worth of families has been put into a larger database where some of the most impactful discoveries are made, like the recurrence of autism in a family, for example, as well as the determination of intermediate phenotype, where some challenges are observed in siblings in the absence of a diagnosis. The group shared their new ideas and their new data to spark interest in collaborative projects. This year, more than any other year I can remember, it was focused on biology. This included studying brain activity through EEG, or direct measurement of the brain, non-invasively, of course, brain structure and function, and even biological measures of attention. These practices are being more and more brought into clinical practice, but don't get me wrong. Right now, most pediatricians' offices will not be able to quickly whip out one of these machines to do an assessment. You'll still need to go to a special appointment. But why are they important? Well, a new study released just this week from the Infant Brain Imaging Study, part of the Baby Siblings Research Consortium, examined brain connectivity across different areas of the brain and whether or not these connections were essential for repetitive and restrictive behaviors. Oh, and here's a twist. The brain was examined at 1 year and behaviors were started to be examined at 1 year, but some of the behaviors didn't emerge until 2 years of age. So the question was, how do brain circuits develop that affect later repetitive behaviors? And if there is some evidence for this, is that period from 1 to 2 years a perfect time to reshape, remold, and rewire the brain in a way that could help mitigate some of these repetitive behaviors? As it turns out, different connections between different brain areas are involved with different types of repetitive and restrictive behaviors. Guess what? It's not just one brain region, it's not just one gene, and it's not just one behavior. Some brain connections are more involved in ritualistic sameness versus other brain connections that are involved in stereotyped behaviors. And these happen at different time points. So it isn't just an all or nothing thing. Different brain regions develop over time and underlie different types of repetitive and restrictive behaviors. Unfortunately, though, there was not a brain region they looked at that was associated with self-injury. Self-injury is an incredibly complicated, repetitive, and restrictive behavior, and of course, it needs further study. So back to the meeting. Well, what was really the point of the meeting? Well, number one, nothing beats a good face-to-face to get the science going. And sharing the most recent data findings allowed them to determine what they should be pursuing on their own and what they need to be collaborating on. Now, this could take the form of joining projects together to better understand the behavior, the biology, or both. And as a side note, the prevalence of autism in these siblings is 20%. And there's a lot of variability there. There's a lot of factors that may confer resilience. Why do some people end up with a diagnosis and others don't? Why do some respond to intervention and others don't? Even the ability to access an expert clinician regularly across these early years may help the family, even if the diagnosis is still autism. Scientists need to better understand what confers resilience in these siblings. It's partially being female, of course, but what else is there? What could we turn into therapies to help children with autism who are struggling with things like communication and social interaction? The period of infancy and childhood is critical. Of course, it's not the only period of development that deserves attention, but it should also not be forgotten. And also, a special heartfelt thanks to Autism Speaks, who helped make this meeting possible. These sorts of collaborations don't just happen because researchers want to get together. They happen because funding organizations are willing to take a chance at them. Thank you so much for listening, and talk to you next week.